Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is David Bainbridge. He's a comparative anatomist in the Department of Physiology, Development, and Neuroscience at the University of Cambridge and a fellow of St. Catherine's College. And we're talking about his book, Paleontology, an Illustrated History. David, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book because I'd wanted to be a paleontologist all the way through until college. And the college I went to had one paleontology class, and I took it, and that was it. And I went on to other things.
I think quite a lot of people, especially when they're young, they quite like the idea of being a paleontologist. I mean, I must admit, you know, I'm definitely not a full-time paleontologist. I train as a veterinarian. I've done various things. I've been mainly reproductive biology. I now teach comparative anatomy, but a bit like you, in 1 year of my course, the main year of my degree, almost all of my focus was on paleontology. It's one of these things I'd always wanted to do, and ever since then, I've followed it. Obviously, when you teach comparative anatomy, you can't really escape paleontology. So it's just one of these things. You just feel very envious of the people who actually get to do it full time.
I know, and I love this book. It's more fun than any other history of paleontology I've ever read. In the foreword, you write that writing this history revived really vivid fossil related memories at the Natural History Museum in London. Talk to me about that.
Yes, well, I mean, as long as I can remember, I've been interested in this stuff. And I just remember I was the irritating kid who every birthday would want to be taken up to London to go to the Natural History Museum. excuse me.
That's okay.
Sorry, I had an alarm when I was expecting you to ring.
Okay. And there's a gallery of ancient fish there, right?
Yes, there was. I suppose I was slightly unusual in that obviously I like the dinosaurs, but you go off into these little side galleries, which I'm sad to say don't have the same things in them anymore, and they were full of this stuff that just looked really weirdly old. The fossil fish, which probably were about twice as old as the dinosaurs, but they just looked like they'd been run over by a truck, hundreds of millions of years ago. And they just looked bizarrely archaic. That they just seem even more alien than the dinosaurs, which, you know, you always think of them as being more spectacular. But it was something about those weird fish that really caught my attention.
Yeah.
And then, of course, years later...
Like placoderms. Did you look at placoderms and stuff like that?
Placoderms, I mean, there are so many of them. After you get into paleontology and you realize that vertebrates are basically mainly fish. With a few little things that grew legs and eventually clambered up onto the land and things like that, but you could do a whole lifetime on just fish paleontology.
Oh, yeah.
Like that sort of thing. Yeah,
this is a wonderful book, and as advertised, it's an illustrated history. Now, certainly, I was familiar with a lot of the photographs or the illustrations, but there's an awful lot I had never seen before. How challenging was it to find all these illustrations?
Well, it was great fun, really, because, like you say, you kind of want a balance between the pictures that everybody's expecting to see, because some things have to be in there.
Yeah.
And then there are other ones where, I mean, one of the great things about just going through the scientific literature is if you look through the scientific literature, it's not an image search. It's not giving you the most spectacular or the most well-known pictures. But then, so it's really by not looking for pictures, just looking for the research and what people have found and the history. That's where you find the sort of weird and interesting ones. I mean, one of my favorite ones was by an artist called Zallinger. And he did a painting of a Tyrannosaurus lying down asleep in a rainstorm.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just think, you just don't see pictures like that in the sort of, you know, the popular books. But of course, that was the one that I decided to put in because I just thought it was so unusual. You suddenly think, well, yeah, of course these things had to sleep, didn't they? And it was just a rather sweet picture, really. So it was a bit of a mixture because you want pictures for their sort of visual impact in a book like this, but also you want pictures that you don't think anybody will have seen before, because you could probably fill a 256-page book with paleontological pictures that you know, somebody who's interested in this sort of thing will have seen virtually all of. But I thought, no, let's find just often by the same artists or the same researchers, yep. but just slightly different from the famous ones.
Now, weirdly, as you write in the beginning of the book, and there is text to this, I want to say to people, you write, and this is one of those things that until I read you saying this, it never occurred to me, that paleontology is a relatively young science, though cultures have been handling fossils and writing about them and talking about them for many, many centuries. But it's a young science.
It is. I mean, it kind of arose really as a proper science, really about the same time as geology, about 200 years ago. And, you know, you look back now and it's amazing to think that nobody knew about the age of the Earth or sedimentation or fossilization. They just find these until 200 years ago. That seems remarkably recent. And obviously there are written records of people finding things that we now know are fossils. But until 200 years ago, almost nobody really knew exactly what they were. There were a few people, and they did write about it. There were some Islamic writers. Leonardo wrote about it. There's a guy called Steno, a Danish
guy. That's right, that's right.
And they all seemed to know what was going on, but it wasn't really until the beginning of the 19th century that this became generally accepted. People either thought they were sort of mythical things put in the rocks by God, or that rocks just spontaneously produced animal forms. So, but yeah, only 200 years. I just find that bewildering, really.
Well, in, as illustrated and written about in your book, it's really interesting. People, cultures had to make several leaps of understanding in order to even accept what these are. They first had to understand that change could occur in Earth. And that may sound unusual to people who are listening, that people didn't understand that change occurred in Earth. But people thought the creation was just permanent, obviously, because God made it and was perfect.
Yeah, so first of all, the Earth had to be old enough for all this stuff to happen.
And that was the other big idea. They had to understand how old everything was. But first, they had to accept change.
Yeah, it had to change, and it had to have time for that change. And that's just the Earth, let alone the animals that are on it. And again, yeah, I mean, it's only really 100 years ago that people realized that the continents move around the place over very long time periods. And, of course, they've all got animals standing on top of them, and those animals go where those continents go. And that was only 100 years ago. So it's sort of almost every 50 years you get one of these great big, you know, what we nowadays call a paradigm shift, where people suddenly realize there's this fundamental gap in our understanding of how all this worked.
It's incredible, as things proceed to the end of your book, how many different ways and how technology is really aiding paleontology.
Yes, I mean, this is one of the things I found this with a lot of my books, is as you get towards the present day, writing a book where you're trying to find striking images actually becomes easier.
Yeah, obviously,
The thing about science nowadays is there's so much of it going on, and the sheer volume of data is so huge that one of the real challenges is actually finding a way to present all that data in a manageable way. And usually the best way to do that is in pictures. And so people are developing ever more inventive ways of representing what they've seen. And so many of the pictures towards the end of the book, they're just straight out of scientific research papers. They're not by paleo artists. They're just by people who they've got this important thing they want to convey. And they obviously sit around with their research team for days and days working out how they're going to present this. And it often comes out in a beautiful image or a beautiful or striking image at the end.
Let's skip around through the book, because I'll just pick out a couple of things that I was sort of amazed by. We should talk about Mary Anning. And in your section on Mary Anning, one of the amazing things I had never seen before was her drawing of the plesiosaur.
Yes. I mean, the strange thing about Mary Anning, and it makes you realize how different society was at that time, is that we think she did a lot. We think she found lots of these fossils herself. We think she characterized what they actually were herself. We think she drew many of them herself and sort of put them in the public domain. But because she was a woman, there's any sort of fragmentary recording of this. There's fragmentary recording of all of her doing all of those things. And we suspect that probably she did most of those things for most of the fossils that she's linked to, and probably for quite a lot of fossils that she's not linked to as well. And, of course, at that time, that was just kind of taken for granted. And it's quite sad, really, because she almost had to rely on a couple of male champions to sort of really fight her corner, you know, with varying degrees of success. because people assume that a woman couldn't be doing this. And so the strange thing about her is her knowledge of what she did and her knowledge of her life as well is quite fragmentary. And there was a recent film made a couple of years ago called Ammonite about her. And they basically have free rein because so little was known about what sort of a person she was. We can kind of see she was incredibly important, but unfortunately lots of what she achieved may have been ascribed to other people, well, men, basically.
Yeah. There are sections where your book takes these weird little digressions into sort of entertaining weirdness. The Crystal Palace dinosaurs. Talk to me about those.
Yeah, well, this is, again, it's another little snapshot in time. And I actually hadn't been to see the Crystal Palace dinosaurs until about 3 years ago.
So, I just want to check. They're still there.
They're still there.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
They've just had a big renovation done on them. But they were for the great exhibition in the 1860s in Victoria in London by the Crystal Palace, which was part of that exhibition. They're really the only thing that is left, and it's a part of London called Crystal Palace. It's not very central. You have to go out of your way to get there, and you have to walk across the park to find them. But there is this pond, a very large pond, and it has these big concrete life-size, replicas, what they thought these dinosaurs looked like at that time.
And that's really revealing. They sort of looked at these things as sort of lumbering underneath their own weight.
They did. Well, I mean, it's still quite hard to believe some of these things could move around, as they probably did. I mean, when I talk to my students about flight, I still say to them, I still can't see how pterosaurs, for example, is a pterosaur.
The Quetzalcoatlus, we still don't understand how they get off the ground.
How do they get off the ground and how do they get back on the ground without smashing themselves to pieces? I just can't see how they do it. I mentioned that because there's a pterosaur there hiding in the bushes in Crystal Palace. No, these things are still there. It's just this weird bit of Victoriana. I mean, even at the time when it was when they were created, there were people who were disputing whether these dinosaurs actually looked the way they did there. So even by the time they were produced, some people thought they were a bit out of date. But no, they're still there. There's still this sort of weird vestige of the sort of early years of British paleontology. I mean, one thing I try and sort of make clear in the book is it's kind of, there are geological reasons why paleontology really got started in Britain. But actually, we've got very few good dinosaur fossils.
That's right. And especially recently, it's mostly from China and from other places in the world.
We had the early European phase. Then, of course, we had the amazing American phase. And now we're really into the Chinese phase because all these fossils with incredible degrees of levels of detailed fossilization that people, 30 or 40 years ago just assumed couldn't happen. And lots of these things are coming from China. It's just like it depends where you are. It started off in Britain because Britain is just like a perfect geological map of the last 600 million years in diagonal stripes, neatly arranged. Then it moved to America because all of these huge things were just kind of eroding out of the ground in Wyoming and Montana and Colorado. In the, as you say, now it's all China.
Yeah. They're staying with the Crystal Palace dinosaurs a lot. I just love that whole thing. There was a dinner that occurred inside the iguanodon mold.
Yeah, well, because these things were made of concrete, originally they were quite robust. So you could actually get inside them, and there was a small sort of function room inside the iguanodon where people had dinners. And one of the images we found is an invitation to one of these dinners.
I love that. I love seeing that invitation. Of course, Richard Owen was there, and there's a lot of people in this book, a lot of interesting characters. I've always been fascinated by Richard Owen. He's very, very important, but thoroughly, as you write, unlikable.
Yes, which of course makes people more interesting. He was incredibly important. He was one of probably the most important person in the 19th century as far as linking fossils to an understanding of basically the arrangement, the layout of animal bodies. That was his obsession, is linking those two things together, the sort of morphology, the structure, the segmentation, the patterning of organisms, and then the fossils that you find in the ground. And he was hugely important, but he was obviously a completely horrible person as well. And he just did so many terrible things. You know, he'd always be trying to take other people's discoveries and thoughts as his own, and trying to sort of hide what other people had done to make himself look better. He was obviously a completely loathsome character, but he was instrumental in getting the London Museum of Natural History started. So I suppose that is one thing we have to thank him for.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is David Bainbridge. He's a comparative anatomist in the Department of Physiology, Development, and Neuroscience at the University of Cambridge, and a fellow at St. Catherine's College. And we're talking about his book. If you've read a lot of paleontology books, even as an adult or a young person, this is a special one. Paleontology, an Illustrated History. How important were Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace to our understanding of fossils and where they belong in time?
Well, the interesting thing about those two people is, first of all, it was two people. They both pretty much simultaneously came up with the idea. It was a joint paper, originally, the publication of the Theory of Natural Selection. And people had been thinking that evolution, that animals change, for about maybe 50 years or so, since people like Jean-Baptiste Lamarck in the early 19th century. So they thought evolution occurred. They thought animals changed. So many people thought that species could split into two species and things like that. But they had no idea what mechanism there could be. Also, of course, nobody knew how old the Earth was, and it was very important that that was sorted out in the interim. People realized the Earth was at least 20 million years old, which now seems very short for the length of the Earth, but it kind of started to seem long enough for this change to take place. And, of course, what those two did is they gave us the mechanism by which evolution takes place, which is natural selection. And you always think of evolution as natural selection as being the same, but evolution is the process, whereas natural selection is the actual mechanism by which it occurs. And it's amazing. You look at those two. I mean, they could do that. They could have this amazing earth-shattering idea. But they had all these other interests. They had different interests from each other as well. So, for example, Charles Darwin was very interested in things. He was interested in fossils. He was interested in the evolution of man. Whereas Alfred Russel Wallace, he was very interested. He was really the sort of first of biogeographer.
That's right. Yeah.
He was interested in how animals had ended up distributed around the world in the way they have. And within a decade of the original publication, they were already sort of taking that as read and going off in all these other directions. So it wasn't just that they came up with the mechanism, which really did sort of fix itself in the public mind in the last half of the 19th century, but then they just created these other fields of biology as well. It's quite remarkable. It's also very interesting that one of them is incredibly famous and one of them isn't.
I know, it is. Everybody knows Darwin. Very few people know Wallace.
Yeah, well, Wallace was very self-effacing. He actually wrote a book about evolution, which he called Darwinism.
Wow! Wow!
And that just seemed to be the kind of guy he was. It's just his character, I guess. They were quite lucky in a way. A geologist called Charles Lyell, who was sort of almost a sort of patron figure to both of them. He was the one who suggested that they'd co-publish at the same time because he realized independently from them that they were coming up with the same idea. So if it hadn't been for him, we might never have heard of Wallace at all. So it's only really because of him that they published together in the first place. So, Darwinism by Wallace. I mean, it's amazing to think that somebody could be that sort of quiet about themselves in science nowadays.
Now, for people who've never heard of it, there have been some fakes. And my favorite, by far, is Piltdown Man, which you write about in the book. I love this story. Can you talk about Piltdown Man?
Well, Piltdown Man is particularly, it's great if you're British, because it really speaks to sort of British chauvinism.
It really does.
People had started to find, fossil humans in places like Germany and France and in what's now Indonesia. And the British obviously felt that this didn't really reflect the importance of the English, especially, on the world stage. And so when somebody essentially created a fake fossil from a hominin skull and a modern ape jaw, people will just immediately take it in by thinking this was a new and distinctively English fossil, and it was sort of, and that there was this sort of lineage of this wonderful British race going back.
Didn't somebody bury a cricket bat too?
Yeah, it was alleged. There was something found with it, a big slab found with it, which was alleged was the precursor of a modern cricket bat. But the bizarre thing about this is it was decades before
I know
suddenly realised that this was complete rubbish. But it just shows, you know, that's chauvinism for you. When one nationality thinks that they're better than everybody else, they can trick themselves into all sorts of things.
Now, one of the other things that your book does is it makes you aware of certain key fossil deposits. For instance, the Sonthofen limestone deposits in Bavaria are critical, and people don't. I'm surprised more people don't know what that is. But let's talk about that.
Yeah, it's just a bed of limestone in quite a small area of Bavaria where the limestone was just laid down in layers, very obviously in a very, very calm environment, because what you get is this limestone can effectively almost be peeled into leaves, like the leaves of a book. Obviously, it's a bit harder than leafing through the pages of a book, but effectively the limestone does cleave into these slabs, and every so often, you find on these, so each of these slabs is a layer of sediment that was laid down hundreds of tens of millions of years ago. And every so often, a beautiful fossil appears. Most of these fossils are fish, because as we've already established, paleontology seems to be mainly about fish. But possibly the most famous fossil in the world was found in those limestones, which is Archaeopteryx, which is, you know, if you had to design a missing link between dinosaurs and birds,
that's it.
It would look exactly like Archaeopteryx. I mean, you can see why people might have thought it was a fake, because it's too good to be true. You know, it's a thing with teeth and a big long reptilian tail, and yet it's got feathers, fossilized feathers. I mean, who would have thought that would ever happen? And even things like its pelvis, because birds have done a thing to the shape of their pelvis compared to their dinosaur ancestors. And the pelvis of Archaeopteryx is exactly halfway through that process. And so, you know, if ever anything was, you know, all ready to be a fake, it was this. I mean, they found one feather first, and then they found the whole thing. And it is just like, you just look at it and you think, this is just telling me exactly what happened in the origin of birds.
We're almost running out of time. But another really important and, for me, amazing fossil deposit is the Burgess Shale. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, the Burgess Shales are just, you sometimes can't believe that some fossil deposits have actually formed and survived. Because, I mean, many animals don't fossilize very well. Vertebrates fossilize quite well because they have bones made out of mineral. And many mollusks fossilize well because they have shells made out of mineral. But most animals don't have mineral in them, and so they fossilize very rarely, and presumably if they do fossilize, the very sort of subtle imprint of them on the rock just gets smashed to pieces over the eons. Whereas the Burgess Shales is this deposit in Western Canada. It was discovered around the turn of the 19th into the 20th century, where you get imprints in the rock of these creatures before there were bones. So this was an era we thought we'd never actually see. But not only do we have amazingly detailed fossils of soft-bodied animals, but it also just happens to be at the time when multicellular life was going through this amazing period of experimentation. It's sometimes called the Cambrian explosion. And so there are some animal types there that you think, oh, that could be an early vertebrate, or that could be an early millipede, or that could be an early crustacean. And then there are other things where you think, I have no idea what that is at all. And presumably some of these things didn't keep going. Because one of the striking things, if you look at multicellular animals, there's about 25 different ways that multicellular animals put together nowadays, and vertebrates are kind of one of those. But you can sort of see this period of experimentation in this little bed of shale halfway up a mountainside in Western Canada. And so it's partly the time that it was formed, but it's partly the time that it formed at all, the fact that it formed at all, and it's partly the fact that it survived. It's just almost unbelievable.
And there's life forms there that don't seem to be related to anything that we know from later. Like Hallucigenia, which is illustrated in your book, it's just one weird-looking creature.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And some of these things, eventually, you know, some of these things, you look at them and you think, oh, that's related to so-and-so. And some of them, it takes years, and then somebody realizes they're related to a modern form. And then there are other ones like that one you suggest. I mean, it was so strange. They didn't know which way up it should go. And many of the early sort of reconstructions of it had it standing what we now think is the wrong way up. It had a sort of tubular body and a funny sort of, well, bulbous head, although people argue about what shape the head actually was. And then it had lots of little, what looked like soft tubes sticking out one side, and then it had these little spines sticking out, or big spines sticking out the other side. And people, there's been this long argument over whether the spines are on top or the spines are underneath. And we just, some of these things, we just don't have any point of reference for them to know which way up they are. I mean, another famous one was quite a large creature with this big circular mouth. And for a long time, people thought the mouth was a jellyfish that had fallen onto a dead body of something else. But no, it's all one big animal. It just shows that when at this time of tremendous experimentation, it's just really hard to work out, you know, where one animal starts and where another one ends.
I know there are some creatures represented in your book, like the Tully Monster, which is the nickname of the creature. It's just a weird, that's like, you just look at that and you can sort of see maybe it's related to certain things, but that's one really strange looking creature.
It is, yes. I mean, that's the thing, is you just think, well, what happened? Why did they exist in the first place, and what happened to them? And it's, I mean, they seem to think now that they're related to modern jawless fish, but...
Wow.
I think it's just certain aspects of their anatomy seem to tie in with that.
Everybody listening should Google that right now.
Yeah, Google a Tully monster, and it was a real thing. and probably its most close relative is possibly something like a lamprey.
My guest tonight has been David Bainbridge. He's a comparative anatomist in the Department of Physiology, Development, and Neuroscience at the University of Cambridge and a fellow at the St. Catherine's College. And we're talking about his book. It's more fun than any other paleontology book you've probably picked up, Paleontology in Illustrated History. David, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.